Somebody was asking me last evening, and I don't see the person here, for some further information. I think if we know something of the J.R.R. Tolkien book on the Hobbits, we know that those stories have a great similarity in terms of their sort of fairyland character, to use a rough term, and Lewis's Narnia series. And the question was, how close were these two men? Actually, Lewis knew Tolkien very well and encouraged Tolkien, who was a sober-sided scholar of the older English, Middle English, for example, which is usually a requirement for those who take doctoral degrees, but is not exactly the kind of thing that comes out with new comic strips or popular books. But he had been working away, according to a single statement that I read, on these Hobbit stories for most of his lifetime. And Lewis said, hey, you know, get them into print. And the result, I think we know, you see the Tolkien books in the hands of children and older children and for sale here and there. There's another interesting connection. I say they knew each other very well. For those of you who might sometime want to probe into more of the comings and goings in Lewis's life, he belonged to an informal group called the Inklings, I-N-K-L-I-N-G-S. I don't know if they gave themselves that name or not. I don't think it started as a named organization. It was very informal. They had some evening meetings when tea was served. And then, if one of the members of the group had been writing recently and had a chapter done, Lewis, who was sort of the acknowledged leader of the group, would say, has anybody written anything? And the person would read aloud that segment of whatever work he had, and the rest of them would listen, and when it was over, they would go at it hammer and tongs. They were very friendly, but they could also be very critical. So that Lewis's works also, when they were at this stage, would have gone through that same process. There was another meeting, and some of this information comes from reminiscences of Warren Lewis, C.S.'s older brother. And the other meeting was on Tuesdays, about an hour before lunch. They would gather at a pub for talk. They were not drinking people. To meet at a pub in England did not mean that they were about ready to go to a treatment center. Just a good, quiet gathering place. And I like the change of name that they gave to the pub. I don't know how old it was, but it formerly had a sign out in front, the Eagle and Child. Well, this group called it the Bird and Baby. Some of this information I have drawn from that picture book, C.S. Lewis Images. And that's one of the books on that reserve shelf. And if you have some spare time, it's the kind of thing that you can just page through. So you can be scholarly and academic and doing research, and there are beautiful pictures in pretty muddled arrangement, to my mind. It's not chronological. And there are some groupings of pictures. Of course, it's a composite. Many of the pictures are black and white, but there are some lovely colored ones, too. And, you know, when that's set up, you have to do something in the gathering of your hands of printed material to take account of this. the press wants either black and white or colored. There is also some material in that about Lewis's wife, Joy, and I'm not saying, well, there are not enough here to really be serious with you, but there are few enough here so we can be sort of cozy and we can play it sort of by ear. And I hope you will enjoy hearing some more things, both about Lewis and about his marriage to this woman named Joy. I'll just again give some bibliographical notes and a little bit more of sketch. As I say, in the book Images, C.S. Lewis Images, you will actually find some pictures of her. They do not exactly favor her. For one thing, as I mentioned last evening, her problem was cancer, a cancer of the hip, so you see her standing, supporting herself with a cane. And although at the time the pictures were taken, she was in remission, she's not the kind of vital person that Lewis first met. The strange romance, which began with Joy Davidman writing to Lewis to tell him that he, through his writings, had been instrumental in her conversion. And that is recorded in another file folder here. In the story of her conversion, in a collection of such stories, under the heading, These Found the Way. A number of people, not all of them very well known, I didn't Xerox the listing. But they're brief statements, and out of her story, I would like to read just a little bit of the marvelous revelation of God that she had that brought about her conversion. She was married and living in upstate New York, I guess you would say, had two children, and here it breaks in. My husband had been overworking. One day he telephoned me from his New York office. I was at home in Westchester with the children to tell me that he was having a nervous breakdown. He felt his mind going. He couldn't stay where he was, and he couldn't bring himself to come home. Then he rang off. There followed a day of frantic and vain telephoning. By nightfall, there was nothing left to do but wait and see if he turned up alive or dead. I put the babies to sleep and waited. For the first time in my life, I felt helpless. For the first time, my pride was forced to admit that I was not, after all, the master of my fate and the captain of my soul. All my defenses, the walls of arrogance and cocksureness and self-love behind which I had hid from God, went down momentarily, and God came in. How can one describe the direct perception of God? It is infinite, unique. There are no words, there are no comparisons. Can one scoop up the sea in a teacup? Those who have known God will understand me. The others, I find, can neither listen nor understand. There was a person with me in the room, directly present to my consciousness, a person so real that all my previous life was, by comparison, mere shadow play. And I myself was more alive than I had ever been. It was like waking from sleep. May I intrude here what I cited from Paralandra about the woman who says, how can you step out of God's will? Conversion to Joy became aliveness, real life, not the kind of frantic striving for success that she had been into before. And I myself was more alive than I'd ever been. So intense a life cannot be endured for long by flesh and blood. We must ordinarily take our life watered down, diluted, as it were, by time and space and matter. My perception of God lasted perhaps half a minute. In that time, however, many things happened. I forgave some of my enemies. I understood that God had always been there, and that since childhood I had been pouring half my energy into the task of keeping him out. This amazing parallelism, God pursuing, and she's like Lewis, resenting that threat of interference. I saw myself as I really was, with dismay and repentance, and seeing I changed. I have been turning into a different person since that half minute, everyone tells me. When it was over, I found myself on my knees praying. I think I must have been the world's most astonished atheist. They can hear. Not quite the strength of Lewis's reluctant, but not captured by God. Now, I think you've enjoyed some of the things you've heard Lewis saying and some of the things I've been saying about him. And have thought, well, you know, that's fine. I can understand that. And to hear about God pursuing, about God coming down, yeah. Meanwhile, you know, we wonder what the great theologians are talking about. Well, I would have you understand exactly these things in different language. Karl Barth, who has been accorded the at least potential title of the greatest theologian of the 20th century. If you haven't heard the name before, don't worry. He's sort of the theologian's theologian with a massive book of church dogmatics like that, volume after volume after volume, all kinds of many languaged footnotes. Made as one of his major points a kind of polemic against the idea he saw first in his Switzerland and Germany and his teaching and his developing, and certainly when he came here to visit he found the same thing, the idea that all of us are busily seeking God. We're trying to find God. Barth said, not so. It is God who seeks us. That's the scriptural word. We don't have references among all the wealth of references in Lewis. He might have been aware of Barth, and he may not have, but he had the same sense. And Francis Thompson wasn't sober enough, long enough, to hear anything. I think he died before Barth anyway. But the Hound of Heaven is saying the same thing. God so loved the world that he came. Didn't say, well, I'm here. Let them find me. And here I say you have the same parallel idea. Joy Davidman said, God came. We may argue about the reality of such an intense, almost physical presence and say, oh, she's kidding herself. All right. So she kidded herself right against her own intentions into a conversion. Now, where's the nonsense? You figure it out. In accepting what she says happened, or in saying, I don't believe it. Now, back to the little romance. Subsequently, Joy and her husband began to have marital problems. He did survive that strange incident. And she was converted. Actually, her husband also was later converted through Lewis's writings, but that didn't bring them together again in marriage. She, as I say, wrote to Lewis, eventually came to see him. There's an interesting note here in the diary of Warren Lewis where he claims that he could see what she was after. She was really gunning for his brother. But Jack couldn't see it. Now, all that background, we'll have to admit that although sometimes Jack, that was the family name, C.S. Lewis, Clive Staples, I'm sure he preferred Jack. didn't have much experience with women. He wasn't romantically inclined. Well, to cut off some of the details, which I don't remember anyway, Joy was in England, and part of her before I became a Christian story was that she was a card-carrying communist. You remember the McCarthy era, and the way that we treated people who had been card-carrying communists, and the way the English did too. So they were about to refuse an extension of her visa. She was ill. She had her two sons with her. And in a kind of, well, apparently gentlemanly gesture, Lewis married her in a civil ceremony and gave her the protection thereby of British citizenship, so she could not be sent back. Well, goes on from there. She had the remission, but the acquaintance had deepened into love. She was displeased about having a simple civil ceremony, and eventually they had a church ceremony. And she lived long enough so that instead of being this legal spouse who was living off here and he was living going his way, she did come to live with C.S. Lewis, and by that time his brother Warren was also living there too, so it was an interesting family, although Warren by now had been reconciled and came to respect Joy for what she was, a very vital and interesting person. He will record that also in his memoirs. Joy had wanted for much of her life, apparently, to see Greece. And there was a time given when she was well enough so that she and Lewis could go to Greece with another couple. And she managed that very well, came back. And the ups and downs, Warren records them for us. At one time they thought she was dying, and he notes that she fooled us and the doctors again. But death was inevitable, and she died. Now, two things, if I can find what I want here. First, find the notes. This isn't as easy as it should be. Now, here. That's why I have these. This is from C.S. Lewis's grief record. And you may have seen this book on sale in the bookstore. You'll see it, I think, out on that table. It is called A Grief Observed. And since it is very personal, Lewis had it published first under a pseudonym. And then it came about eventually identifying him and Joy. Just to indicate the character of her faith, the holding power after those momentous moments when she was grasped by God. This is the last paragraph of A Grief Observed. How wicked it would be, if we could, to call the dead back. She said not to me, but to the chaplain, I am at peace with God. She smiled, but not at me. And then follows, I think it's an Italian sentence I don't understand. But that's enough. I'm at peace with God. And she smiled as one welcoming another life. It reminds me of a memorable line in A Man Called Peter. Some of you may recall it also. Peter Marshall had had that heart attack in the middle of the night. And the ambulance came and took him into the ambulance, and on his way out, he said, good night, dear, I'll see you in the morning. But she did not see him again because he died in the hospital. One of those beautiful things that speaks of another morning with a capital M. I'm at peace with God. What follows in this book? Publishers sometimes need to have a book that does not slide between the seat and the back and the front seat of the car and get lost. So they append things. And in the afterword by Chad Walsh, now he tells us there is a sort of a summary of Surprised by Joy and the life of Lewis that on some occasion you may scan through and say, oh yes, I remember hearing about that, but you don't have to read the whole thing for it. Then, I gave last evening that epitaph of Lewis's, which after about 2 years finally satisfied him. Her body was cremated, and her ashes lie sort of in a wall of the crematorium, and there's just a very small end piece there for the memorial. And I wanted to read it to you in its wholeness and in the exact words of Lewis himself. You read the formal, "Remember Helen Joy Davidman, died July 1960, loved wife of C.S. Lewis. Here the whole world, stars, water, air, and field, and forest, as they were reflected in a single mind, like cast-off clothes, was left behind in ashes, yet with hope that she, reborn from holy poverty in Lenten lands, hereafter may resume them on her Easter day." That is one of the most elegant and poignant, I think, of Lewis's writings. And with that, I shall muddle my file folder of Lewis material for another week or so and try to pick up a Mayura folder here. And introduce some materials and something of a perspective on this book, which is of a completely different character. Those of you who may have read parts of it see it almost like a piece of fiction. Iacu does not belabor us with a lot of intellectual references to books that she has read. She has manifested her literary skill, but there is more narrative, and there are really several romantic lines here, instead of none, as you have in Lewis's Surprised by Joy. We have to append that. That's our own afterword to Surprised. Now, this sounds like a nasty, chauvinist statement. I don't want it understood that way. But there is a preoccupation in a Japanese woman of the time, which is post Second World War, Japan, a preoccupation with the proper career of a woman, marriage and a family. There is an undercurrent then of frustration that because of her continuing illness with tuberculosis, that is closed off. Now this is cultural, it is not that she was sex mad or anything like that, or sick. There were those who alleged that she was too much interested in men, that she did not talk to the women patients but preferred to talk to the men, and therefore, of course, there was sort of the allegation that she was trying to get them hooked. I think it is far more true to assess that interest of hers to her intellectualism. And that, of course, is a nasty word too, but She shows herself in her writing and her subsequent success in the field as a woman of above average, far above average mental capacities. And she says some things that we've probably heard, and we've responded variously to it. Women were always talking about their babies and their household affairs and sort of gossiping. I remember in the parish, there was one of those sort of little problem areas. There was a group, not the ladies' aid, but an evening meeting group, and most of the women there were working girls, probably looking for marriage. And a few young married women, the same sort of clash. The unmarried ones said, all they want to talk about is their kids. I don't have any kids yet. Well, they kept on, and eventually most of them had their own children, so they could join that. Now, that's sort of a minimal introduction to this personality. And I think because we're dealing in this book and with Ayako and the other characters, we do need to see a difference in culture. Now, you might feel this is really superfluous, since I judge that by Monday many of you will be on your way and reading something else. I just have the boldness to assume you might see this book sometime and pick it up and read it through and be grateful for some introduction. Besides that, I've got my outline. I've got to stick to it. I told Elmer that that's about what I would do, and I don't like to tell too many big lies. But I think it's helpful also to understand how different our cultures can be. Now, this is probably not necessary for most of you. You, I mean, guests have traveled more widely. And for that matter, even traveling about in our own country means that we are exposed to people who have different outlooks. This is a good meeting place for people from east and west and north and south. But let's face it, unless we have lived for a considerable time in a foreign culture and have done something else than stay in the Hilton, we don't appreciate how very often in little things there is not a meeting of the minds. Now, sometimes we assume that international differences can be settled very quickly. We just get together and we talk and we understand one another clearly. We have the same motives. We look at things in the same way. So why can't we settle these things? And just a bunch of bums there and incompetents who are sitting in administrative roles and United Nations and ambassadorial offices and so on. But it's not that simple. In fact, the difference in the biblical culture, particularly in the Old Testament, is one of the things that draws a heavy drape between us and a clear understanding of this. Paul talks about we see through a glass darkly over against God, but we see through a glass darkly over against many of the Old Testament figures. There are differences not only in such everyday affairs as hospitality. There are differences of relationships that are established by the simple fact of eating sometimes certain things together. Tom and I are frustrated by having our scheduled hours at the same time. Tom said, well, what am I going to do? I'm going to miss out on that. I wanted to hear you start out, and I'm going to miss out hearing about the Baya. I can't pronounce it the way he does. One of the little things he said is the right hand among those people is the hand with which you give. If you give something with the left hand, it's insulting. We have a considerable world on a world of travel, but international study program going at St. Olaf, and we have to brief people. Sometimes we have groups who are going to be studying in Thailand in universities. And some of the parents enjoy this. They don't enjoy paying the extra money for the travel. But there are rules that are laid down that are not laid down here. I can remember our present president, when his daughter was in Thailand, sort of gloating over the fact that this gal who, well, she preferred to go around barefoot when she could in a Minnesota climate, and dressed very indifferently. She went to a university where there was a uniform. And whether you liked it or not, you wore this, and it was the same uniform as everybody else, and day after day you wore this. You jolly well conformed. Plus the fact, I heard that there were some rules that girls did not sit like I see my girls in class, you know, sprawl like this.
No matter where they are, you know, there's not going to be a single coffee table in the United States that is not going to be marred by hook marks of our young people if they keep on the way they are at school. But there, you learn that a proper young lady sat with her knees together. She didn't even cross her ankles. Sometimes, you know, you do win for a little while. Of course, they come home and they go into the old sprawl again. But cultures can dictate this. And when we look at them, we say, that's weird. That's stupid. Of course, they have the joke too, because they look at us and they get together in their hotel rooms as they're visiting and say, my, what weird, stupid people these are. They do things this way and that way. I think one of the images we have is of Japanese who seem to laugh a lot, titter and laugh, and we wonder what's wrong. Well, some of that is built in, some of it's embarrassment. Doesn't necessarily mean that they're laughing at us, but it's something that's developed in their particular culture. Now, over against what's happening here, there are factors of the Japanese mind, and particularly the wounded Japanese mind after World War II, that are always the sub-ground of what's going on. I don't have the background here. I've been working at it with some diligence, but I don't have the language access, and, well, you work with 7 books, and you can't do 40 hours a week research for a year on one book. One thing I discovered by reading Ruth Benedict's Anthropological Studies might be well if I'd heard a long time ago, and if many people had heard. Why did the Japanese start the Second World War? Why did they invade China? Well, our Western idea is they were in a constricted island area, not always too hospitable, and very much short of resources. They needed more land. They were crowded in. So they went out to get it. And China has a lot of land, a place for lots of people, probably even more than their, 600 or 800 million. That's not right, according to Ruth Benedict. This was a kind of crusade on the part of Japan, as she sees it. They were out to give the Chinese, who were closely akin to the Japanese, the benefits of a superior civilization. The Chinese needed to be shaken up, and the Japanese were in a position to do it. And, of course, in their large-scale plan, we obviously needed it too, because we were lacking in their superior viewpoint. Now, we can understand that, I think, because we have things that we have accepted in the nation. I have not been a great student of American history, but I have heard American historians talk about manifest destiny. Why did the colonists keep moving farther and farther and farther west? Some of it was the acquisition of land. There were Native Americans there, but no matter. Their culture, their whole outlook on life was inferior. At first there was an attempt to Christianize, there was an attempt to bring them up to this new culture from Britain and France. But then that sort of got overlooked, and the main thing was just to expand geographically. But it started with something of the same mission. Let's help the benighted Native Americans. Their life is too simple. They don't work hard. And we had a nice hard-nosed Protestant ethic saying, it's really a shame. Of course, maybe they had it made, but they looked at those Native Americans. The men were hunting, fishing, and between times sitting around, palavering, and the women, of course, never seemed to have it too easy, but the women didn't have to be terribly fussy about keeping up, a three-story house and keeping all the children nice and clean all the time to send off to school. There were a lot of things that they didn't have to do. So let's shape them up. Well, let's accept that as one of the premises. It may be incomplete and it may have some misdirection in it. But there is no question but that the self-image of the Japanese depended upon their success in war. And they lost. Hiroshima was achieved. Atomic bombs or whatever, they had to submit to an unconditional surrender. There was no chance of sort of a negotiation. It was this or go through more war and more destruction. Now, how does a young woman who is a public school teacher get caught up in this mesh, other than with a sense that she is a citizen of the defeated nation? I mentioned in one of the earlier lectures the name of Paul Tillich and ultimate concern. Paul Tillich talks about idolatry and about making an idol of your country, which does not mean that you have some kind of an altar to Domitian or to Reagan, but it just means that, you know, my country right or wrong, and everything centers in the success of your nation. There is that. And it also came to a point for Eyako when, with the American military forces supervising the whole of post-World War II Japanese culture, including education and politics, there's a day when she was told, we are going to change your textbooks in school. Your books have been teaching things that we do not tolerate, ways of life, and they are not spelled out here, and it's not critical. They could not reprint and reissue new books. So each teacher was given the instruction, now have your children sit down and take erasers and erase certain things in the books. They were offensive. Well, many of the teachers were doing this, and Eyako at first was also doing it. But this is the way it struck her. This was not just a matter of a kind of a general invasion, but her person was involved. She had told these children in the prior weeks and months that this was the truth. was not just that it was their book, but this was what she believed. Now, she is involved in a flip, and she says, this is not true. I don't know how to contrast that, unless a teacher were to come into one of our schools and say, well, now, children, I will have to admit, I have been very harsh with you when I have caught you cheating. And I have scolded you. I have penalized you in your grades. Because I said, cheating is wrong. You must not cheat. You must not look over at your neighbor and get the answers there. You must do your own work. But now we're going to change that. You can cheat all you want. In fact, the more you cheat, the better. Now, what kind of a teacher is this? Isn't the school board going to move in and say, we better send her off for psychiatric tests? She's flipped. For Ayako, this she mentions as the triggering that said, I cannot do this, I'm not going to do it, I resign. But that, of course, does not change the course of the war or her situation. And there is much more that she's also undergoing. This is just the sort of the tip of the iceberg. All kinds of things are changing in her society. Changing partly because things are at sixes and sevens, and partly because the administration, the foreign administration, says it is going to be changed. There are things like the structure of government, of course, from the emperor on down. The emperor is deposed, and now instead of looking to him with praise or blame for whatever happens, Japanese people are to make their own decisions. And no matter what we may think about how wonderful democracy is, those who haven't hit it don't necessarily appreciate it. They would rather be able to have somebody else make the decisions. So she's going through this along with the rest of her people. The role of women will be changing, and while this is not sort of a feminist statement, I've indicated that from her own sort of intuition, Ayako is something of a feminist. As I said, she breaks some of the conventions and prefers to talk to men. She has in mind to achieve something beyond just being a baby bearer and so on. But the Japanese society between then and now will see that tremendous revolution in the role of women, I think much more distinct than even the revolution that we have seen now. I haven't so far cited Peanuts. I've had some things in mind to cite because there's so many elegant illustrations there. A while ago, Lucy was all excited. She said, I just realized, and this was after Geraldine nominated for vice president, she said, you know, I just realized that I could become president of the United States when I grow up. And then in that mercurial way that Lucy has, she said, but I probably won't have the chance to be the first one. Well, if you read sort of between the lines, you see something of the interior struggle of Ayako, the new woman and the old, the old society condemning her because she's a flirt and wants to talk to men. We know some of the things about technological development that are changing life. One of the things that does play in, and it's up for next time some more, and that's the matter of health. For most of us here, to read that Ayako had tuberculosis, seems, well, you know, She could just go to the hospital, have a good rest cure, get some medication, some surgery. What's this about just one hospital after the other, surgical process, and then this tuberculosis of the spine, and lying there immobilized for months and months and months? Well, that is partly post-war Japan, in need of all kinds of foods and medicines. It is partly just the state of medical development there. And the World Health Organization, I think, in that intervening time has done a great deal to disseminate better methods and to come in to the rescue in cases of real epidemics. But illness and the lack of adequate nourishing food is something that she experiences in post-war Japan. There are matters also of family structures and a sense of worth. May I just call attention to one more thing here that seems to have been part of the Japanese outlook in their own conduct of the war. And this is from Ruth Benedict. She indicates that there was a disregard of the Japanese for the damaged goods of injured and sick soldiers. Now, that meant that there was not in the Japanese army a tremendous paramedic structure such as we tried to provide. The medics were there trying to save lives, heroic measures. There were base hospitals and field hospitals, and new medicines were tried, and there was a glorying in the fact that, not that we were going to get men back to fighting, but that we were saving lives. The Japanese tactic seemed to be, if somebody was hurt, you couldn't waste more time on them. You had to press on and win the battle. All right, Ayako was not fighting in war. She was not a woman soldier. But there's that same idea. Ruth Benedict uses the term of damaged goods. She's really no good. She's a parasite on society. She's draining things in as a patient in a hospital. And while Ayako does not mention this as such, she does have this sense of, what am I doing? What can I do? I just don't have the strength. I'm drawing on the limited resources of my parents. My mother has to wait on me. You don't do much for yourself when you're in a cast. She's worthless. There's serious talk and an attempt on her part to commit suicide. And what I've announced here, that really grows out of this business with the children, erasing standards, and looking at herself as a longtime patient, that life is meaningless. Life is worthless. It's not worth the effort. Now, I'm not saying a great deal about that because, again, we're getting on down and I will have to pick up. There'll be a new group that will need some server orientation here, and I won't have to introduce the end of Lewis to them because, well, I can say it as bluntly as I once heard Victor Borge at a one-man show in New York. He was going on in his usual way. I think you've seen him on television, probably heard him in person. But he has this line of chatter, you know, he's somewhere or other in the program, he's always going to fall off the piano bench and go through some other antics, and he has these wild stories. And he was in the middle of playing something, quite seriously, and I'm not sure to this day whether it was people who had come late to the theater or whether it was some setup, but a couple of people came down along the side aisle and found seats toward the front. No, it wasn't planning. That spoils my story. I've told this wrong before. But he was telling a story, And they came and disrupted it. Finally sat down, and he just gave them a good, hard Danish stare and said, "You will never hear the beginning of this story." And he went on with the rest of it. So, some people will never hear the beginning of this series. They come around on Monday and haven't been here before. But the question of the meaning of life, it sounds trite. And sometimes people go around just maundering over this. And a related question is, who am I? Who am I? And that gets sort of wearisome. It's sort of like a wild story I heard about a father who was thinking about what he seemed to see around him a lot. He said, "My kids aren't going to grow up and then when they get to be up in their 20s have to go to a psychiatrist to find out what's wrong with them. I'll tell them right now." Who am I? Well, it does matter. Ayako's ego is shattered. She's been doing something. She's told it's all wrong. She's, you know, like a disbarred lawyer or a doctor prevented from carrying out his career. Well, for a lot of retired people, like they can't get away from the sense that they've been rejected. You hear people saying, "I've been put on the shelf. Nobody needs me any longer." And there's just a pervasive sense, life has lost its meaning because I have lost my work. It's a tremendous job of understanding we can't deal with right now. Again, you won't hear the end of the story because next week I expect to get into Hammarskjöld and his markings. And one of the key statements that he makes there, Hammarskjöld, writing largely out of the time when he was Secretary General of the UN, you don't get much higher than that, said, "I ask an impossible thing of life, that life should have a meaning." Now he's going on, doing a fantastic job. But inside, he's saying, what does life mean? What is worth something? Well, I'll tell you the ending. He does come to the point where in a kind of quiet conversion, life assumes a meaning. But imagine a man who worked as he did, 20 hours a day, driven, saying, what's it all about? What am I doing this for? Well, sure, honor, glory, I don't want that. I just don't expect an answer. And Ayako's statements early on, he says, there's nothing. I can be indifferent to my health. She was scolded by a good friend, her first fiancé, after her sickness, because they would bring some sake into the hospital, and she joined the boys in drinking, and she smoked. With tuberculosis, she smoked. He said, you shouldn't do that. She said, why shouldn't I? Or why should I do anything? There is nothing that has any value. Well, I can sort of, I know it's more important. No, not more important, but very important to get up there and see what the barbecue is about. Since you're very special people the first week here, and you aren't around, you haven't bought the book, may never read it, what happens? I can do that quickly by looking at the title here, The Wind is Howling, and telling you what the title comes from. You don't realize it, but I think you all know the hymn from which this title came. Of course, everything changes in translation. I don't find this hymn in a lot of new hymnaries, but you know, Jesus, lover of my soul, let me to thy bosom fly.
while the near waters roll, while the tempest still is high. The wind is howling is their translation. Hide me, O my Savior, hide. This, then, in her spiritual autobiography, is the way, in retrospect, she sees her life. Raging winds, the threat of death. But at the end, and since I mentioned the romance, which eventually works out not with the first man who died also of tuberculosis, but with another man who strangely resembled him, she's well enough to go through her wedding in spite of some fears that she's having another attack, disease. And happiness is in the offing. She has found some things to do, to make some money, to contribute to her own and the family's income. And the very ending, the last line, is, it was a warm spring evening without a breath of wind. That's the poet in her saying, you start out while the tempest still is high, and you go through the tempest, and your Savior is there, Jesus Savior, pilot me, and at the end, everything is calm, at peace, and I have found meaning in Jesus Christ. It's a beautiful story. Well, I don't give you time to discuss, but I'm pretty good on timing it, you see. I haven't got that. I know you wouldn't think about this anyway, and I'll tell you why you shouldn't think about it. Don't ever ask me to preach in your congregation, because I have got a clock in me that is a 60-minute clock.
Well, we thank you.
Yep. You're very welcome. Have a good barbecue.